Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 146. My name is Terry Frost, and this time we're doing a couple of space operas, and why not? First off, we're going to 1984 for Peter Hyams, 2010, The Year We Made Contact, starring Roy Scheider and Helen Mirren. Then we move to the 1960s, the late 1960s, in fact, for Hammer's only real space opera, Moon 02, starring James Olsen and Catherine Schell. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start breathing vacuum. Martian Drive-In Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Okay, so how is everybody going? Let me just turn the microphone around the right way. So weather's warming up, which is kind of nice for us. Not nice for people in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're doing pretty much okay. Everything's fine from that point of view. Planning the Japanese trip as well. Finished up with the ABC local radio Northern Territory gig where Rebecca McLaren and I talked about the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. So we did the last one of the year, which is always a bit sad. I mean, at the end of the year, you get a hiatus while the Northern Territory's evening programming gets shifted to the evening programming for South Australia. And so the local people aren't working in the evenings, and my gig disappears for a month or two. So I kind of miss that, because then next year I'm still doing it, so that's all good. Everything's fine there. But you kind of miss it when it's not there anymore, even though I haven't quite gone 2 weeks without doing it. You still kind of miss it. It's an odd thing. By the way, we are using the Richard Rule in this podcast, as always, so talking about the two movies will start at the 15-minute mark to assuage the concerns of dear friend of the podcast, Richard H., who doesn't like me waffling before the movie talk. So, Richard, 15-minute point, you'll be right, mate. So things have gone kind of weird here politically in Australia, as usual, and our Prime Minister is about as popular as a positive biopsy. But, you know, we're hopeful for next year. I did the Kris Kringle again for the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema Facebook page does a Kris Kringle every year. And I did it again this year. I'm about to send off a whole box full of DVDs and books and things to the person who got me as Kris Kringle, and I'm awaiting my delivery of my stuff. There's always interesting stuff there when you do the GGTMC Kris Kringle. It's a really wonderful thing, and you end up with some weird and interesting stuff. So stuff sometimes outside the comfort zone, and that's kind of good, because when you're a movie buff, you can kind of settle into the stuff you know you like and not go anywhere else, a bit like a fussy eater. But getting random DVDs and videos, and send them if you want to. I mean, I'm happy for listeners to send me things. In fact, good friend of the podcast, Armin, is sending me a care package of German stuff, which is lovely. And thank you very much, Armin. You've been a supporter of the podcast for a long time. And I really appreciate the fact that you are. And plus, getting a bunch of DVDs is fine. The DVD room in the back of the house, I really should put up a picture on the Facebook page, is kind of getting large. I'm winnowing out a little bit. Things that are a bit prosaic and ordinary and kind of you can find anywhere, I'm slowly getting rid of. So I'm going to kind of distill the DVD and Blu-ray collection down to an essence of films that are hard to find here in Australia, and they're a little bit quirky. So I'm doing quite good with that, plus classic films and things like that, and you're never going to get rid of those. But there is a process of, do I need this? am I going to watch it again is another one. So I'd rather somebody who appreciates them gets them, and you can kind of recycle them that way. And there's still people who collect DVDs. There's still people who collect VHS tapes. There are any number of VHS tapes out there that are being scooped up by VHS bandits, and who still like them. Increasingly, of course, it's going to be harder and harder to find VHS players or even Betamax players. There are some people, benighted though they are, who like Betamax and have active Betamax collections. But for me, I kind of like the sharpness of DVD and Blu-ray, particularly Blu-ray. As my TVs have got larger, the quality of VHS tapes looks worse and worse on them. And so I've kind of upgraded to that. There are things, of course, you can't find on DVD and Blu-ray, but increasingly that's changing as people who were addicted to certain movies during the VHS era want to see them in high definition, want to see them in widescreen rather than pan and scan. And so there are smaller companies that are putting out product from the VHS era. But for me, I'm happy with the change. VHS tapes, of course, are a lot bigger than DVDs, and so the storage issues become commensurately large. And I'm trying to kind of weed out stuff I don't need anymore. In fact, the garage sale that Sally and I are doing on the weekend is partly about that. We're kind of winnowing out collectibles and things like that that we just don't need. Your tastes change over time. You kind of elide into a different area and you go, okay, well, I used to like that stuff, but I don't kind of like it now. Got to get rid of the Bill Cosby and Kevin Spacey action figures. Though I am keeping the Quentin Tarantino one. Actually, I don't have a Kevin Spacey or a Bill Cosby action figure. Though I can see a certain perverse market for those products. I did tell you that I met Kevin Spacey once, didn't I? I'm not sure if I have on the podcast. I probably have, so if I'm repeating myself, I do apologise. But back in 1998, when the world was young and dinosaurs ruled the earth, there was a press conference, a very, very small one, for a kind of slightly obscure actor called Kevin Spacey. People knew he was a good actor, but he was actually directing his first movie, a movie called Albino Alligator, which I'm going to have to revisit one day. And so my good friend Ali Kane, for whom I was writing for her festival blog, said, hey, Kevin Spacey's got a press conference in half an hour. Do you want to go around the corner and attend the press conference? Now, I was working for the Commonwealth Employment Service at the time, which was the big employment service in the country until they fucked it. And so I went, yeah. So I snuck out of work, went around the corner to Melbourne Town Hall. And in the basement of the town hall, in a small room, maybe for 30 or 40 people, Kevin Spacey was there talking about movies and talking about Albino Alligator. So there are a couple of things about this. First off, it was the first time I kind of got wowed by seeing a movie actor, because there is that kind of wall between you and them when you see them on the screen that isn't there when you meet them face to face. So I was a little bit stunned. Second thing is, he's got a fucking enormous head for his body. Kevin Spacey's head is about 1.3 times the size of a normal human head. And in spite of all the things we know about him now, he spoke very cogently about film as an art form and actually said some things that I've kept with me about film being such a young art form and how they're still learning what film is about and how to use it. The vocabulary of film is increasing. The grammar of film is changing and evolving, but it's a very, very young art form compared to most of the other art forms we know and recognize. So I kind of like that kind of stuff. There's useful things he said in there, and the press conference informed my review of Albino Alligator. So I got to meet him, got to shake his hand, that kind of thing, because he went around and glad-handed everybody. But there was a slight freakiness about him. I'm not sure what it was. Maybe an offensiveness, but just a freakiness about him, which was oddly off-putting. This is months before he won an Oscar. But, yeah, meeting Kevin Spacey was a weird thing, very, very weird thing. But, you know, life throws weird things at you and you kind of got to go, okay, that's a weird thing, but it's all part of that great panorama of life. By the way, as I'm recording, I'm actually drinking a Lebanese soft drink. I went into one of the smaller greengrocer stores, you know, a fruit and vegetables place locally, and picked up a drink. It's called Freeze Mix, Freeze without the E on the end, Mix. It's a carbonated flavored drink, lemon and ginger flavored, and it's pretty damn good Picked it up quite cheaply. It's got everything that's bad for me in it: sugar, regulators, malic acid, trisodium citrate, natural and artificial lemon and ginger flavors. But it's actually pretty good. And when I picked that up, I thought, that's weird. Here I am. You can go into a shop and buy soft drinks from the other side of the planet quite cheaply, in spite of the fact that they've been shipped in shipping containers all the way across the Indian Ocean and the Southern Ocean to get to me from the Middle East. So, yeah, the 21st century is a very weird place. I mean, thinking back 20 years, just say around the time that I saw Kevin Spacey, even at that stage, it was a weird thing for you to buy things from the other side of the planet. It was difficult. Exchange rates and ways of getting money to and from A to B were non-trivial tasks. But yesterday, I actually bought my Christmas present, because Sal and I got a bit of a windfall, and I bought a Christmas present, which is a motorized gimbal for my DSLR Nikon D5600 camera. So basically, I'm going to be able to put a proper camera onto a gimbal to stabilize itself. I'm doing panning shots. If I'm doing time lapses or hyperlapses or slow motion or panning shots or anything like that, the gimbal will let me do that basically by programming it, and it'll keep the camera steady as I pan or as I hyperlapse or as a time lapse. So there's lots of great things about that. But the point of that is, apart from the fact that I'm going to be able to do beautiful cinematic footage for the YouTube channel, is that I bought it from China because I got the best price on it in China. I saved myself about $100 or so on this wonderful device. And buying it was crazy simple. I just had to go in there. I had to press purchase, so one click. I then got taken over to another screen which said, do you want to pay now? And I clicked yes, so that's two clicks. And then a third click when I was in my PayPal to pay for an object which is about 8 hours flight time away from me. So somebody in a factory somewhere got the message, got the money, and is sending me this wonderful gimbal by mail. And that took three mouse clicks. And that's something I do on a regular basis. I buy little things from wish.com that I might want to give away to somebody, or that kind of fulfill a collection that I've got. And all of that is significantly easier than me going down to the bakery and buying a loaf of bread, or going down to the fruit and vegetable place and buying a Lebanese soft drink. It's a lot simpler than doing that. And occasionally you get that kind of future realization that, yes, you're living in the future of where you used to be, and you're doing things with very little thought. And I often buy impulse purchases because they cost $5 each or something ridiculously small like that, without the realization of exactly what a technologically elaborate thing you're actually doing. And now and then you have that kind of realization. You go, okay, I'm doing this, and it is a miraculous and complex thing for me to do this, even though my experience of it is dead simple, three mouse clicks. Behind the scenes, there's a lot of shit going on that enables me to get that thing that I want, to enable me to do things that I want to do. That, of course, takes me back to the GGTMC Kris Kringle, where Big Willie and the Samurai basically are organizing a swap meet on a planetary scale. The whole planet is involved, people all around the world. They had to split it up into geographical regions just to make it easier to do. But these guys, who are lovely and out of the generosity of their hearts, organize this every year. Getting people together, getting people of similar tastes together, getting them to exchange presents, and increasing the amount of goodwill in the world by this incredible technological means. It's a truly amazing thing, and one that which we don't appreciate because we're all too busy getting outraged at Donald Trump, binging Netflix TV series, which again is an elaborate thing technologically, and doing all the other things we do on a daily basis just to keep ourselves alive. But I think I'm just going to pause for a moment and reflect on the wonderfulness of the 21st century, and 2018 in particular, when we can do this shit. But it's time now to talk about the movies, because I've hit the 15-minute mark. So here is the trailer for 2010, The Year We Made Contact, from 1984.
How are you going to convince your people to allow Americans to go on the flight?
We are going to get there first, and you have the knowledge to make the trip work.
I'm going on the flight.
How far away is Jupiter?
Far.
Mommy said you're going to be asleep for a long time. Are you going to die?
Dr. Floyd. Dr. Floyd. Dr. Arlov has encountered some strange data coming from Europa.
I will send Max down with a pod.
I wouldn't do that.
Oh, really?
If you want to send a pod down there, send an unmanned one.
Hey, a piece of pie.
Cake.
Piece of cake.
Cake, yes.
If this data is correct, then there's something down there.
It is correct.
It was organic. There was life.
Is it moving?
Yes.
It's incredible. Listen for a minute. We've got to get out of here.
I can't do all of these things with no reason. I can't
Forget reason. There's no time to be reasonable. Can't find him!
Are you sure you're making the right decision? I think we should stop.
See, something's going to happen.
What?
Something wonderful.
I've never really hidden the fact that I don't particularly like 2001 A Space Odyssey. In 1968, it was a breakthrough from a number of technical viewpoints, I'll admit. The space stuff is fantastic. The monkey stuff is fantastic. The giant space baby in a bubble is pretty good too. The light show is fantastic from a 1968 viewpoint. But if you strip away the technical achievements of it, which again are considerable, it's pretty fucking boring. These guys find a thing on the moon. The thing on the moon contacts a thing in Jupiter orbit. They send a ship out with two boring guys on it and a whole bunch of stiffs frozen. The frozen people glitch and die. One of the guys gets killed. The other one meets a black monolith and turns into the giant space baby. That's pretty much what happens in this movie, apart from the prelude with the monkeys. And it takes fucking forever to get there. It really does. It's long, boring. True story, I saw it at the Astral Cinema about 15, maybe 20 years ago. On the big screen, 70mm, old school flea pit in Melbourne. When they got to the bit where Frank Poole gets killed and Bowman has to go out in the little module and grab the body, it was so slow and boring that I actually reached for the remote control in the cinema to fast forward it. One of the things attributed to Kubrick, the director, about this film is he wanted to make space travel boring because he considered it was boring, and so he made it boring. It's the biggest adventure the human race has ever undergone, and this stupid motherfucker, who's made some great films, made it boring for no good reason apart from his ego. None of the actors are given any characters that have any human traits at all, really. They're atrociously bad from the writing viewpoint. There's no character arc for any of them except going on this journey. And it's fucking annoying. Now, this is a hangover, of course, from Arthur C. Clarke's work. Arthur C. Clarke, for all of his technical knowledge, the fact that he thought up geosynchronous satellites, the fact that he was an ideas guy in the science fiction field, leaving aside the fact that he did like to fuck young Sri Lankan boys, leaving that aside, he was a great science fiction ideas guy. But when it came to character, he couldn't write a character to save his life. And that's one of the problems with 2001 is there are no characters in it at all. It's all kind of light show and wow and nothing behind the front door. 2010, for all of its problems, and there are a number of them, is a little bit different. They try to humanize the characters, one of whom, the protagonist, Heywood Floyd, played by Roy Scheider, who's never bad on the screen. They try to humanize him, and Scheider does pretty well with a script that doesn't give him terribly much original to work with. And we like him from the start because he's Roy Scheider, and he puts it across very well. Charismatic as fuck actor, Roy Scheider. The story's pretty simple. It's a number of years later, of course, because 2010 is 9 years after 2001. And they're going to send a couple of missions, one from the Russians, one from the Americans, to the orbit of Jupiter so that they can find out what went wrong with Discovery and investigate the mysterious monoliths even further. Problem is, the American ship's not ready yet, and so the Russians decide to arrange for a few American scientists who have the technical expertise to reboot the Discovery spaceship when they get there to come along with the Russian crew and the Russian ship, the Leonov, and try to find out what the fuck is going on. This is in an environment, you've got to remember, this is before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the USSR. The Russian tensions are still going in this kind of posited 2010 future. Russia and America are having a war in Honduras. And the Cold War tensions are ramping up to the point where it may end up being a shooting war. In fact, there are initial kind of forays into this as the movie progresses. This, of course, dates the movie. It was made in 1984, directed by Peter Himes, by the way, but I'll talk about that in a sec. But it was made in 1984, about 8 or 9 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the crumbling of the Russian Empire, until they reformed it into a totally different kind of oligarchical empire as it is today. There's very few people in the science fiction world thought that the Cold War would ever end. And it did. When it did, it was a shock. And a lot of people said, well, we didn't guess that. We're not futurists or science fiction writers. We do what ifs. We don't necessarily do prognostications of the future, which is a fair thing. So this movie's got a lot of that kind of dated stuff in it. A lot of the technologies are very dated. CRT monitors, the computer graphics, the special effects. There are some matte lines around some of the special effects as they get into the Jupiter orbit. But on the whole, it's got a lot more characterization in it than the original film. And it's actually got something to say, and it's got some nice wow moments as well that are kind of worth us checking out. Directed, as I said, by Peter Himes, a director who did a lot of kind of science fiction-y stuff, but was never fantastically good at it. He did Outland, which is essentially High Noon in space. Let's see, Capricorn 1, which I hate because it kind of slyly dog-whistled to the possibility that the moon landings never happened and thereby created a whole conspiracy industry. Let me see, The Presidio, Narrow Margin, the remake of that, Time Cop. He did do The Relic, I'll give him that. The movie of his I like best is probably The Relic. He did a really bad science fiction movie based on a Ray Bradbury story in 2005 called A Sound of Thunder, which really doesn't work because there's one enormous plot flaw in there that I can't ignore. And even though some of the special effects in that are pretty good, it just simply doesn't work for me. So, yeah, he was a kind of jobbing director, never enormously gifted, but generally commercial. And you know, his movies tended to make money. Now, the supporting cast in this is pretty good as well. You got Helen Mirren wearing a perm and a mullet, so you can't really knock that. Nor can you knock the fact that Helen Mirren is playing a Russian because she is of Russian heritage. Her character is Tanya Kirbot, who's the commander of the Russian ship, and she does a really nice job of it. You also have John Lithgow playing Dr. Walter Kernow, who is one of the technical experts. You got Bob Balaban playing Dr. Chandra, even though he doesn't look anything like an Indian guy, who is the computer genius who created HAL and HAL's sister, Sal 9000, that's sitting on Earth helping Chandra with his research. You got Keir Jolley playing Dave Bowman again and doing a good job. You got the recently late Douglas Rain doing the voice of HAL, which is kind of cool. You get people whose faces you know from television. People like Dana Eclair, who played the boss in MacGyver, the original series, playing Dmitry Mostovich, the Russian guy who contacts Hayward Floyd about going on the flight. You also get some nice scenes with an actor I really liked for a very short TV series he did. And that's James McGeachin, by the way. He did a TV series about a black insurance investigator called Tenafly, which I really about liked back in the day. I'm trying to find out when Tenafly was. I'm just scrolling through his IMDb now and fascinating all of you while I do that. Let me have a look here. 1973 to 1974. Good, solid series. It was out contemporary with things like The Rockford Files and Harry O. And, it was one of the kind of, it was a African-American private eye. Nice series. Really wish it would come out on some form of DVD or Blu-ray, but some of these series just don't have the prominence and don't have the friction against popular culture to get a release. Only ran 5 episodes. That's probably the reason why. And, you know, fuck American television for not doing more of that kind of thing. So to get back to the movie itself, you've got some Russian actors playing Russian astronauts. You've got people like Ilya Baskin playing Maxim, Savilia Kramarov playing Rudenko, and a few other Russians there, and also a female cute Russian astronaut called Irina, played by Natasha Schneider, who is not related to Roy Scheider. I'm trying to look through her IMDb. She's actually Latvian. She's not Russian. Didn't do a lot as an actress, but did write a bit of music, which is kind of interesting. She's there for one scene where there's an aero-braking maneuver that the Leonov has to do to slow down as it goes around Jupiter. And the way they do that is they have a whole bunch of big balloons they put out in front of the spaceship called Balloots, which give it a wider profile. And basically, as it dips into the outer atmosphere of Jupiter and it gets slowed down by friction, there's a lot of heat involved, and then they can swing into an orbit around Io where the Discovery spaceship is. So she's there basically because she gets a little bit scared as they're doing the braking maneuver, and she hops into the capsule with Roy Scheider so she's got someone to cuddle. And that's pretty much it. It's kind of a scene that doesn't particularly play well from a modern viewpoint, and I can't really see a narrative reason for it to be there. The special effects of that are pretty good, which I appreciated for the time, of course. In fact, all of the special effects in this are pretty good for the time, with the exception of the bit with the matte lines around it as people are travelling between the two spaceships, the Leonov and Discovery. We get Hal again. Hal is a kind of boring AI, really. He's calm and smooth talking and kind of genderless, but with a male voice. I really liked Hal. I mean, the fucker killed an astronaut for a start. And apart from that, there's just kind of, you try to get a grasp on what this AI is about, and there's just nothing there. It's like a frictionless surface when you try to figure out what it is, and it's really annoying that so many of these characters are underwritten. And again, the fault there lies with Arthur C. Clarke. The other cool thing is it's 2010. They've got some kind of old 1980s laptops that Floyd works on when he's back at home talking to his wife and his young son and the dolphins that they have in their backyard. There's nothing so dated as something that tries to look kind of near futuristic in a movie. There are so many of them that do it incredibly badly because technology sometimes jinks right when people think it's going to jink left. 2010, there are no mobile phones in this one because, of course, mobile phones are a recent innovation. And so you end up with this kind of alternate dated future, which is kind of charming in a way. There's a little bit to be said in its favour, but it doesn't seem right. So this a spaceship full of Russians and Americans is orbiting Jupiter. They link up to Discovery, which is rotating along one axis, oddly enough, just one axis, not more than one. There's no kind of two or three axis rotation on this. It's just going head over heels, in a sense. And suddenly, Bowman, the character played by Keir Gillet in the first movie, turns up and starts warning them that they've got to get the fuck out of there as soon as possible. They don't know how to do it. There are orbital mechanical reasons why it's difficult for them to do, but they find a way, and something wonderful happens. In a very cosmic way, it's basically a change to the whole solar system that happens. in this movie as that goes on. And that kind of works. I mean, that's a bit of a wow thing. It's a big idea to play with. It's portrayed very well, and I think quite simply, there's not a lot of techno babble there, which can kind of confuse people. We get the idea pretty easily that the monoliths are reproducing, kind of like a von Neumann machine. And what they're going to do is compress Jupiter, turn it into a second sun, and all of the moons of Jupiter end up being more or less habitable planets. Europa, which has pre-existing life, which is one of the other subplots of the movie, is to be left alone because, you know, don't fuck with the Garden of Eden when God's around. Because essentially the monolith acts like a deity in some ways. And there is the impression in what the final scene of the movie that Europa, as it is warmed by the micro-sun that Jupiter becomes, is turning into a Garden of Eden. So there are a few kind of biblical parallels there. There's also two cameos by Arthur C. Clarke. The scenes where Roy Scheider and James McKeown are talking outside the White House in the park. The guy on the bench at the other end of the screen, on the left-hand end of the screen, is Arthur C. Clarke. He's not there for any reason apart from, hey, that's Arthur C. Clarke. And then there's a Time magazine cover of the tensions between the Russian and the American presidents. And the Russian president is a drawing of Stanley Kubrick, and the American president is a drawing of Arthur C. Clarke, who, of course, was English. So they've got those kind of little Easter eggs in there for people who like that sort of thing. And there are a couple of issues that do come up, but are never really kind of dealt with in any meaningful way. Hal and Chandra have a lot of dialogue about what it is to be intelligent, what it is to be sentient. And there are some issues there that are brought up, but not particularly nuanced in the way they're portrayed, on AI rights and whether they have the right to ask an intelligent, non-human computer AI to sacrifice itself for other people. So those kind of issues are raised and sort of kind of dealt with. But in a sense, they're the most interesting part of the movie in some ways. Those questions that are raised but never actually completed. And I don't like mysteries either. I don't like mysteries that aren't solved, and we still get the mystery of the monoliths, which are never particularly well dealt with. They're obviously there for some reason to encourage evolution of species. We see that in the first scenes of 2001 with the ape men. Not in a particularly positive way, but maybe violence is the impetus for technological innovation. It would be nice to think that we could find other ways to do it. So it's basically there to encourage life, in, I suppose, in a way, and to encourage intelligent life, which, it's kind of nice, but their motivations are a mystery just like they are. We can play with the silly idea that intelligence is that much greater than themselves and not knowable in any way. But even a cat, I mean, I was thinking about this. Just say that the monoliths in 2001, 2010 are as far beyond us as we are beyond cats. In some ways, cats understand us. They understand motivations. They understand ways that they can push us in certain directions. The cats know us, but they don't know all of us. They don't know that I've got a Facebook page. They don't know how the food gets into their plate and where it comes from, the process by which it's manufactured. But in a basic way, they understand us, and they understand certain aspects of who we are by the way with which we interact with them. But in 2001, 2010, it's just basically, yeah, we're going to make you smart. We're going to put this garden down there. We're going to send a space baby to you. Not even explain things to you, but tell you when things are dangerous. So that's basically, we don't get any idea of who the monoliths are, who sent them, what their origin is. We get nothing at all to kind of grab onto. Again, it's that frictionless surface where you want to understand more about something and you want to kind of get just that tiny nugget of information about these things, and it's not there. And I find that more annoying than luminously mysterious. But having said that, I do like the big ideas that are in this one. I like Scheider. I like Lithgow. I like Helen Mirren in this. I also like Bob Balaban. And, there's some of the characters, as I said, like Dana Eclair and James McGeechan, I like a lot. But for me, it's some ways, technologically, it's not as breakthrough as 2001. I'll give it that. But they both have the flaw of making things less interesting than I want them to be. And, yeah, of course, that is informed by my own prejudices and tastes and things like that. But I want a bit of sense of wonder with my science fiction, particularly when it's on this kind of a scale. And I want to kind of have cool things happening, particularly from a sequel, which is a sequel to a movie that a lot of people misguidedly think is one of the greatest science fiction movies ever made. And again, this is my opinion. You can disagree if you so choose. But I'd like to kind of, I like a bit more humans in my science fiction when they're about humans' reaction to things. And if 2001, 2010 have a major flaw for me, it is the fact that the humans aren't particularly nuanced. And that pisses me off. I mean, yes, I'm getting grumpy because I've racked up a number of birthdays. But I do want characterization. The female characters in this one, too, are fairly lightly drawn. And I think that whether this movie to be remade, say, is a miniseries by Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or something like that, which is probably not going to happen. I think that the first thing they do is look at the characters and try to pump them into three-dimensionality, which is, as I said, the big flaw of these films. But it was kind of fun revisiting it. There were little bits of business I missed. That I forgot on previous occasions. And that's kind of okay. I think that Scheider and Mirren and Balaban and Lithgow were trying to put some kind of life into their characters, but they were pushing against a rubber wall when they did it. It's a missed opportunity there, because I suppose I can blame some of it on the post-Star Wars effect, where Hollywood studios, because they don't know anything, as the late William Goldman has told us, thought that what people wanted from their science fiction was lots of computer special effects, explosions, and characters that didn't get in the way. There was that kind of dumbing down of characterization in science fiction, which Star Wars and its sequels was directly responsible for in the industry. And it's only now that we're pulling away from that and getting the kind of things that I like, which is great ideas, great futures, and solid characters that don't act as stereotypes, have an internal life, have motivations, villains that aren't just bad guys. And this movie doesn't particularly have a villain, except for the military-industrial complex of Russia and America. I just want that little bit extra. I want people in my science fiction, basically. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a very silly science fiction movie from 1969, and it's Hammer's Moon 02, the only Hammer film ever to be set in the future. And it stars James Olsen and Catherine Schell and a great character actor who retired and died here in Australia, Warren Mitchell.
Blast off for the first Moon Western. The year is 2028 AD, and it's really like nothing on Earth. Here are the billion-dollar asteroids of the future. The bizarre machines. The fantastic weapons. The astounding moon treasure that pits man against man. The moon maidens that are part of the prize.
United Nations Space Charter, Section 99B. No sex is permitted in space.
Moon 02.
Got 5 seconds to get free.
the first moon western, where the chase is through space and the death dealt by laser.
Are you walking home? Would you like a lift?
But the shootout is still an old-fashioned shootout.
Please, don't get yourself killed unnecessarily.
Okay, I'm going to start off by saying that this movie is bugfuck crazy. It's insane to think that somebody should have made a space western. There have been space westerns in the novel form. William Rotzler did one at one stage. A lot of the output of Lee Brackett's science fiction was very much repurposed westerns. But she managed to keep it really fascinating for a start. And in genre, her John Eric Stark novels are particularly good. I'm rereading one of them at the moment. As I said earlier, this is the only Hammer film to ever be set in the future, which is a bit of a shame because Hammer's kind of low, medium level wonderfulness, and I've got so much time for the output of Hammer films, really seems a natural fit for the weirdness of this kind of a film. Now, I like the design in this for a start. It's got that kind of 1960s, 1970s futurism, the kind of stuff you see in other ways in TV series like Space 1999, and the old Buck Rogers TV series with Gil Gerard in it. That kind of smooth shopping mall, 1970s, soapy, soft, rounded edges, white-walled, futuristic kind of places with the computery fonts on the walls and all the signage and the kind of Eero Arneo ball chairs. I would love to have one of those ball chairs. I know they're way out of my budget, but I think I could probably fit one in the man cave now I've started to move things around and got rid of a little bit of stuff. Having one of those ball chairs would have been a cool thing. There's actually one in the shop window in Melbourne. It's a standard kind of finished design by the finished designer, Eero Arneo. But it's in the window of the Ugg boot shop. And the whole lot's covered in Ugg boot material. So, you know, like sheep fleece. A whole ball chair covered in that stuff. And it's been there for years. And I think that one day I may well go and smash the window and pinch it. Because in the wintertime, there'd be nothing nicer than having a ball chair covered in woolen fleece to kind of snuggle up in and read books and watch movies from. It's my ultimate comfort place. Now that at the garage sale, I'm getting rid of my beanbag because I don't have room for the beanbag. And they're really fucking difficult to get out of. But it's got that beautiful production design. So that's the first thing in its favour, which I really like. Now, the cast is kind of interesting once you get past the leads. James Olsen, the American actor who was in The Andromeda Strain, plays Bill Kemp, the first man to go to Mars. And now he's doing moon shuttle and moon ferrying work and salvage work around the moon in something that looks like a slightly modified Apollo 11 lander. You've got Catherine Schell, who later went on to play Maya in the second season of Space 1999 as Clementine Taplin, who's come to the moon to search for her brother, who's a prospector out in the lunar wilderness. See, this is the space western stuff. Having a girl called Clementine is a kind of callback to My Darling Clementine. You've got to have the rich bastard. And in this case, it's J.J. Hubbard, played by Warren Mitchell. Warren Mitchell, fantastic actor. I loved him in everything I've seen him in. He was in The Trollenberg Terror way back in the day, another science fiction movie that's bugfuck crazy. And he's one of those actors who looked like he was 50 years old when he was 30. And so he had a long career playing older guys, bald, sometimes with a mustache, Did a couple of good movies late in his career here in Australia, like A Coded Crescent and a few other ones. But Warren Mitchell's in there. Doesn't get a lot to work with, but still he's in there. Adrian Corey, who was in A Clockwork Orange, playing the wife of the Patrick McGee character who gets raped and killed by Alex and these droogs in the film. She's in there playing Elizabeth Murphy, who's a moon cop, a female moon cop. So there is a little bit of kind of gender equity there, not terribly much. There's an Israeli actor called Ori Levy playing Kaminsky, who's Bill Kemp's partner in his little space shuttle. Bernard Breslau turns up as the heavy of J.J. Hubbard. Bernard Breslau, really a fine character actor. He did a lot of Shakespeare, but people remember him most for playing tall, dumb guys in the Carry On movies back in the day. He also did another movie for Hammer back in about 1959 called The Ugly Duckling, which was ripped off terribly and without attribution by the Nutty Professor, Jerry Lewis's movie. It's really hard to find a copy of The Ugly Duckling. If anybody can steer me in the direction of finding a copy of Hammer's The Ugly Duckling, I'd really appreciate it because I have fond memories of it, and it shows Bernard Breslau in a more kind of complex role. I like him as an actor. We even get Hammer stalwarts turning up this movie. People like Michael Ripper turns up briefly playing a card player in a barroom brawl because, of course, this being a space western, one has to have a barroom brawl in there. We have very 60s, 70s English go-go dancers played by a troupe of go-go dancers called the Gojos, who were a big thing in England at one stage. Let me have a look. They were the dancers who were on the TV series Top of the Pops from 1964 until 1968. They do like dance routines to popular songs and things like that. They finally disbanded in 1971, but they are really kind of the time, if you know what I mean, as far as the dancing is concerned. And they are part of the weirdness of this film. Really, it's a totally bugfuck movie. Having a space western for a start is a crazy idea. And they did it on a £500,000 budget, which was big for Hammer, but not particularly big for a movie at the time. And it kind of worked for me in a very odd and fucked up way. The spacesuits are kind of PVC cloth with helmets and things. None of them is going to be at all airproof, but there's a kind of rightness about them for the time and for the set designs and all that kind of thing. You can kind of forgive the slightly dodgy spacesuits. They try to get the science right, which is kind of cool. The fact that it's very cold on the side of the moon and it's in shadow for 14 days of the month. They do some pretty on-point stuff with decompression on the moon and the dangers of the vacuum. They even try to get some of the orbital mechanics right. There's one of Hubbard's sidekicks, in fact, has a portable computer in a briefcase, which helps them with orbital calculations as they go to try to find the MacGuffin in this movie, which is a large asteroid made out of sapphire. It's not particularly large, it's maneuverable. They need it because sapphire is the thing they line the combustion tubes of rocket ships with. It's much more efficient than lining the metal. And if the progress into the outer planets of the solar system are going to progress, there's a big need for sapphire, and Hubbard wants to corner the market on it by grabbing this kind of rogue asteroid, what's more of a meteor, and banging it into the moon and a place that he owns. So the whole idea is to stick a rocket on this asteroid, which they do, and land it on the claim that Clementine's brother owns, but which Hubbard steals from him by the quick expediency of killing the brother. So you've got a kind of gold rush feel about that. The suitcase computer is kind of interesting because it looks like a great big calculator with about as many buttons on it as a calculator. So it's not a particularly well thought out computer, but what the fuck did they know about what computers looked like in 1969 in Hammer House there in Curzon Street in London. 2004, one of the best things I did in London was I actually spotted, totally by accident and serendipitous discovery, Hammer House in Curzon Street in London. And it was the biggest squee I had while I was there. I mean, forget Stonehenge, forget going up into the Snowdon Mountains in Wales, forget all of that shit, and going to the village itself, the village from The Prisoner. Seeing Hammer House was the biggest squee I had when I was in the UK, because of just the things that have come out of that place that formed me as a movie buff. It was a real, real buzz. I think if I went through my old photos of the time, I could probably find a photo of Hammer House. I'm going to have to do that at some stage when I remember where I put those photos from 2004. They're not digital. We printed them all out like good little boys and girls did in 2004, but I really should find them and scan them and preserve them in a more protean form. But to get back to the movie, the acting is not really fantastic apart from the slightly dodgy Warren Mitchell accent, which kind of veers between Russian, English and American for no good reason, which again is a charming thing in the context of this film. James Olsen's never been a fantastically nuanced actor, by my opinion. His hair's disturbing because he's one of those balding guys who at the time in the 60s and 70s, this was acceptable, but since then has become less so, has a kind of comb over. He combed his hair along on one side to try to hide the fact that he's balding, and it makes him, to modernise at least, look a little less reputable than having the protagonist in this kind of a movie should be. If you have a look, particularly in American television in the 60s and 70s, you could have a drinking competition on comb-overs. They really were elaborate and really disturbing neuroses sitting on people's heads. But having said that, I don't like the theme song to Moon Zero 2. It really is annoying. It's kind of got a little bit of backing singers from the Benny Hill Show variety performances feel about it. It's the animation over the titles that accompanies the song is a lot more fun. There's some kind of cartoonish animations explaining how they got from current times to the 2020, whatever it is, of Moon Zero 2. So that's kind of fun, and it kind of works to set up the movie as a fun little bag of tell that you're not supposed to take particularly seriously. So all of that works. Let me see what else I got. I do like Adrienne Corey's character, Elizabeth Murphy. She does well with the role. Again, the writing on them is okay. It's probably slightly above the writing in 2010 as far as giving their characters an internal life's concerned. And she gets to wear some kind of outrageous space fashions. The space fashions in this are either jumpsuits or lingerie. But so there's also that other thing which is really weird in British science fiction. You see it in UFO, the TV series, and you see it in a few other things like the 1976 TV series, which is an English-German co-production called Star Maidens, which has to be seen to be believed. And that is women wearing really outrageous wigs in space. In UFO, they've got all of the women on the moon base wearing purple wigs. In this one, you've got some purple wigs. You've got a few other different colour wigs and some outrageous hairstyles in general. And that's kind of a fun thing, and it very much dates the movie to be of its time, but I've kind of got a fondness for women in space wearing leotards and purple wigs for some reason. Maybe it's because I saw the TV series of UFO at a very impressionable age, but that kind of stuff doesn't bother me. There are some tight jumpsuits on men and women in this movie, which is kind of cool but of its time. I can understand why jumpsuits are a practical thing in space. If you've got to put on a spacesuit in a hurry, the last thing you want is a bustle and all sorts of other kind of frills on clothing. You want something a bit streamlined, so there's a bit of a scientific rationale for that. There's a low-gravity slow-motion bar fight where everybody moves really slowly because they've turned off the artificial gravity in the station, and that kind of doesn't work and seems totally unnecessary for anything apart from the fact that as a space western, this movie is obligated to have a bar fight in it. There are shootouts out in the lunar landscape, which are kind of cool. There are moon buggies as well, which are really nice. They've got six big balloon tires, and they're big round spheres And there are a couple of action scenes in that which actually kind of work, given the technological limitations of a Hammer movie in 1969, pretty damn well. The hero and Clementine are in the moon buggy. It starts getting shot up by gunmen, and that kind of works nicely. And there are some other bits where there are some heating and cooling problems on the moon bug, and they get overheated because the heating isn't working. There are always the problems of oxygen deprivation, having enough oxygen in a spacesuit. So they do kind of at least give a reasonable nod to scientific accuracy in this totally absurd concept of a space western. So props to Hammer for doing that. Ultimately, this movie comes out as a kind of mashup between Barbarella, Space 1999, and just a touch of 2001. There's a scene where there's a satellite retrieval at the start with the two astronauts in their little lunar lander-looking buggy, and that kind of owes a little bit to Kubrick's movie, which is, you know, fair enough. It came out a year before Moon 02, so if you're going to do a movie set on the moon, you're going to be in some way influenced by that. The special effects are actually by Les Bowie, who did a lot of the special effects for Hammer movies, going as far back as the Quatermass experiment in 1955. So he had a long career with Hammer. Pretty much anything you've seen Hammer do which had special effects in it were done by Les Bowie. He worked all the way up to Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, the Harryhausen movie. He did some model work on that in 1977. And I've actually got his book. There's a book by Les Bowie about his work as a special effects artist, which is really a nice read. The movie was directed by Roy Ward Baker, who directed any number of Hammer films, and it did some episodic TV. He did some episodes of The Persuaders and Jason King and The Protectors, the TV series that Robert Vaughn did in England, which I like a lot. Department S, The Champions, The Avengers, The Baron, and then going back, he did some directorial work on The Snows of Kilimanjaro in 1952, which is kind of cool. He also did some work for Amicus, too. Now the Screaming Starts. Yeah, so he did jump the fence and work for Amicus as well as Hammer, which is kind of a cool thing. And if you have a look at some of his early films, Tiger in the Smoke is a particularly good one. He did some nice little action films that weren't Hammer products, but were really sort of kind of solid action flicks as well. Tiger in the Smoke's from 1956. I saw it last year, and it's part of it set in France, part of it set in England. And it's a really nice little flick. But just to wrap it up for Moon 02, it's silly, it's fun. I know that Mystery Science Theater 3000 had a go at it and played with it as well, which is fine. It doesn't take away from the original. But it's kind of one of those anomalous Hammer films. But it's vastly entertaining in a lot of ways. There are bits of it you cringe at, but for the most part, you just kind of accept the silliness of it and go along for the ride, which is always a nice thing with movies that don't have a lot of money to play with and yet want to entertain customers. So it works now in the context of being a kind of retro campy thing, but I still like it. But anyway, that's it for this time around. It's time to knock, knock, knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go. And thank you for listening. Thank you again to the Patreon subscribers who are all uniquely wonderful people. I will be back with another Paleo Cinema podcast soon. I'll probably be doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as one of the movies, which is kind of fun because I haven't watched that since Jesus was playing Cowboys. And another Martian Drive-In podcast the week after that. So in the meantime, take care of yourselves. Watch good movies. Watch bad movies. Keep watching the skies. Enjoy yourselves. Take care. And I hope everything's good until the next time I record a podcast. And as usual, here are the credits in the style of movie credits to honor the singular wonderfulness of the Patreon subscribers who support this podcast by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. And throwing pocket change at me every month. I'll be back soon. Take care. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of movie credits to honour the people who support this podcast. Thank you to Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, our set photographer, Mark D, our extra, and David L, our extra, Kerry H, who is the accountant, and our newest supporter, Gary J, who is a CGFX technician. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. I really appreciate you dipping into your purses and helping out with the podcast.